Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ahead on the show today, singer-songwriter Jason Isbell plays music from his latest album, Southeastern. The former member of the Drive-By Truckers will tell us what it's like to write an acclaimed album before the acclaim comes rolling in. And the story of Mike Bloomfield, the original guitar hero. Eric Clapton and Bob Dylan were fans, and so is our guest, David Frick of Rolling Stone. He'll explain why someone so important is still so unknown. But first,
from Russia with love.
It's time for another installment in our improbably named series, From Russia with Soundcheck. We're looking at Russian pop culture and music in the run-up to the Sochi Olympics. And if you ask the average American to name a Russian band, almost everyone would probably say Pussy Riot. The Russian performance art collective and occasional punk band made international headlines when an anti-Putin song landed two of the women in jail. Both of them are now out of prison and are in Brooklyn this week. They appeared at an Amnesty International benefit last night at Barclays Center, and on Tuesday, these staunch opponents of President Putin did their own version of Meet the Press.
Здравствуйте. Спасибо огромное за то, что вы пришли сюда.
Hello, and thank you for everyone for coming here. The media is an important weapon for an activist in today's Russia. What makes you keep on living and keep on wanting to live, or even when you're behind prison bars, is that feeling of solidarity and compassion that goes even through thick prison walls.
Two members of Pussy Riot talking to the New York media on Tuesday night. Pussy Riot's story has now been told in a new book called Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. It's a remarkable inside look, courtesy of author Masha Gessen. Masha, welcome to Soundcheck.
Great to be here.
So for folks who perhaps have been living under a rock for the last 2 years and haven't heard the whole tale, who is Pussy Riot?
Pussy Riot is a Russian protest art collective that created a fictional punk band called Pussy Riot. And that punk band performed a number of guerrilla performances in various locations around Moscow. Ultimately, they had a performance called The Punk Prayer in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow, which is the biggest and most official cathedral. They prayed to the Mother of God to chase Putin out, and for this they went to prison for 2 years.
Two of them went to prison.
Three of them were arrested
and
sentenced to 2 years. One later got a suspended sentence, so she got out after 6 months. And the other two served out almost the entire sentence.
And are they the two who were on stage in Brooklyn last night?
They are the two who were on stage in Brooklyn last night.
But on the cover of your book, there's 9 or 10 women, so it's kind of a collective, right?
It's an open membership collective, and that's there are two principles that they hold sacred. One is that it's open membership. You put on a balaclava, which is their trademark. You become Pussy Riot. You take it off, you stop being Pussy Riot. And the other is that it's anonymous,
which the balaclava sort of
kind of guarantees.
Once you put that over your face, there's not much to be seen.
Right. So nobody takes roll call. We can't really say how many members of Pussy Riot there are or have been. Many.
But Nadia and Maria, the two who served out their sentences, they were in a very remote part of the Soviet prison system, weren't they?
They were in various prisons, actually. They couldn't serve together because they're co-conspirators. It's like they were actually convicted of committing an organized crime. And so one of them was originally sent to Mordovia, which is a famous gulag that has been largely preserved from Stalin's times. And the other, Maria, was sent to the Urals.
The Ural Mountains, yeah.
And then they both got transferred, one to Eastern Siberia and one actually to Nizhny Novgorod, which was cushy, as prisons go.
So, but Eastern Siberia, about as far as you can go and still be in Russia, I guess.
Oh, you can go farther. You can fly for 11 hours and still be in Russia.
Yeah. So let's listen to a little bit of this performance that got the women from Pussy Riot in trouble in the first place. It's called Punk Prayer. That is Pussy Riot, the punk prayer, which Masha Gessen talks about in her new book called Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. And again, Nadia and Maria, two of the members of Pussy Riot, who were convicted and imprisoned by the Russian government after that performance, were on stage at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn last night, along with Madonna and many others in support of Amnesty International's Concert for Human Rights. So one thing that strikes me about that, Masha, is there is a very kind of DIY, real early punk sound in what they're doing, you know, screaming over minimally musical performance. The media here keeps calling them a punk band, but that's not really what they are, right?
They're an invention. I mean, they're a fictional punk band. The way that Pussy Riot was born was that Nadia, who's sort of the mastermind, who had been a member of another art collective before that.
That's Vojna?
That's Vojna, yes. And who had become an activist, was asked to give a presentation on feminist art during a conference of protest participants. And she sort of decided to do the whole thing. She wanted to give people who had been deprived of an opportunity to hear a freshman course on feminist art to sort of know the whole history. And she did a wonderful presentation, but what she noticed as she got to the end of her presentation is that she got very few women, Russian artists. Basically, there was one woman who had worked in the 80s and 90s who was very commercial, and that's about it.
Everyone else was from outside the country.
Everyone else was Western. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't look very good for an activist to sort of talk only about Western art. And so she decided to invent a Russian artist. And her logic suggested that if there were a Russian feminist artist today, it would be a Riot Girl kind of descendant.
So inspired by the music of Bikini Kill, Slater Kinney, you know, those bands from the Pacific Northwest in the 90s.
Right. I'm not even sure that it's right to say inspired by the music, inspired by the sort of by the ethos,
right,
and the aesthetic. And so she said, as she got to the end of her presentation, she said, and amazingly, there is a group called Pisa Riot. Pisa is sort of the Russian word for wee-wee. It's a childish word
For genitalia,
genitals.
Yeah.
Yes. Is it a group called Pisa Riot that is working today? And she showed a painting that Pisa Riot had supposedly done, and then she turned on the boombox. She took somebody else's music and she overlaid lyrics that were kind of a caricature of what feminist Russian lyrics would be if they existed. and she and her friend, Yekaterina Samotsevich, who was the co-organizer of this whole thing, walked out of the room as the mostly male audience just kind of went catatonic.
Listening to this
invented band.
Which is, the song is called Kill the Sexist.
Right.
So borrowing the music from the British band Cockney Rejects and using a dictaphone to dub their lyrics over the top. That is very punk. This is the fictional band that would come to be known as Pussy Riot.
Мать твоя в грязной посуде, протухшей жрачкой в грязной посуде, пережаренной курицей моет полы. Мать твоя живет в тюрьме. В тюрьме горшки отмывает, отстойно в тюрьме никогда не бывает свободы. Адская жизнь, господство мужчин.
Pussy Riot, Kill the Sexist. So that, Masha Gessen, that would have been their first official.
Yeah,
that's their creation myth.
Right.
So once Nadia has sort of proposed this band out there, now she has to make it happen.
Well, she doesn't have to, but I think they decided they liked the idea. And they actually liked the process. It was just the two of them. It was Katya Yekaterina Samosevich, who was one of the three people arrested, and Nadia, who... And you can hear their voices quite clearly. Mm-hmm. You can actually hear that they had quite a learning curve musically from that first song to Punk Prayer.
Yeah.
But yeah, then they decided that they actually wanted to do a real recording as Pussy Riot, and they found some musicians to help them.
In the case of Pussy Riot, that creative impulse seems to contain a fair amount, a healthy dose of humor.
Oh, would absolutely. You say? Yes. I mean, it's difficult to untangle the ironies. Because, as I said, that those lyrics, which the song that you just played,
"Kill the Sexist,"
"Kill the Sexist," which contains stinky socks and you know, the brilliant punchline, "Envy your own penis," you know, that's clearly they were fantasizing about this wild and bizarre group that that would make up ridiculous lyrics.
Mm-hmm. They also were very interested in kind of documenting their own performances. And one of the great ironies is you tell this wonderful story about Nadia's husband, Petya, is in prison. It's, you know, he and a bunch of guys have been swept off the streets during the demonstrations. And the girls climb up on the – is it a garage?
It's a garage roof, yeah.
And they perform this song, and the cops are waiting for them to get down so they can arrest them. And then it turns out the police have taken really fabulous photographs. and they've been trying somewhat unsuccessfully to document their stuff. And here's the police who've done their job for them.
Right. Right. Actually, you've just conflated two different performances, but they're both really fun. One was, yes, when they performed on the garage roof outside the jail, which was a little bit of a crisis for them because it was their first sort of bona fide performance. What they had done was fictional performances that only looked really like performances once they were on videotape.
Mm-hmm.
And they considered the video clip to be their finished product, not the actual performance. Whereas when they went to the jail and sang for the several hundred guys who had been imprisoned for the demonstrations, they performed for them. And I think they didn't quite know what to think of that, whether they had sort of broken their founding principles. They were all about 2 months old at the time. And then they went to Red Square.
The founding principles.
The founding principles and the group itself, yes. And then they went to Red Square, which is where that incident with the police happened, when the police didn't know how to classify them. They were trying to really figure out whether they were political demonstrators or prostitutes or what, because they were dressed funny. They were, it was minus 20. They were in these sleeveless dresses and tights. And so they brought in these pictures to examine them and sort of try to figure out how to book them. But the women themselves, sitting in the holding cell, asked to see the pictures and were terribly excited about how good it looked. And that's actually the picture on the cover of the book. It was the Red Square performance.
Let me ask you about the title of the book, "Words Will Break Cement." Can you tell us where that comes from?
That's actually a quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the author of the Gulag Archipelago. And Nadia used it in her closing statement in court. And I should say that the trial is one of the most bizarre things, I think, to have ever happened anywhere. It's basically a witch trial that happened in the 21st century in one of the largest cities in the world, the largest city in Europe. As the shocked public looked on. It was very difficult. I think that I have about 50 pages of the trial in the book. It was very difficult to condense it to that because I almost felt like I had to go on and on and on to convey the full absurdity of what happened. And so at the end of that absurdity, where even the defense seemed completely insane, the defense lawyers were totally out of their depth. At the end of this, the three women said their closing statements, which were the first note of sanity and reason in a 9-week pandemonium. And Nadia made this very strong political speech. And one of the things she said was, "In the end, I believe words will break cement."
So they were not aware of, you know, the whole Samizdat culture, but at least she had some awareness of some of the protesters, some of the great dissidents who had come before her.
I'd say she had some awareness. And I know that she read a lot of the dissidents while she was in prison. In fact, that was part of sort of our connection, was that I was sending her stuff to, and other people were sending her stuff to read. And I think discovering that legacy has actually been incredibly important for her and in shaping her activism once she's come out of prison.
So has Pussy Riot, has this whole thing had an impact on the arts and cultural community in Russia, either as a galvanizing or as a perhaps chilling example of what happens?
It's very difficult to generalize. They're so exceptional. They're so sort of anomalous in their very being and in their character that it's hard to say what kind of cultural impact they've had. They've certainly, their arrest and prosecution has had a huge impact on the protest culture.
In what way?
In a couple of ways. One, on the one hand, they have, and this is where I think they've succeeded hugely, is they have managed to shine a light on the problems that they wanted addressed. The symbiosis of church and state, which was sort of an open secret that no one really felt brave enough to address. LGBT issues, which 2 years ago when they brought them up seemed, you know, I didn't realize that was going to become the biggest issue in Russian politics. I was ambushed by it, and I'm gay. And they really realized what was going on, sort of the extent to which Russia was dragging itself back into the Middle Ages. They've also created images and concepts to help people talk about the stuff, including addressing the Mother of God, which has become a meme throughout Russian culture.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, Mother of God, didn't we ask you nicely to get rid of him? But on the other hand, their arrest has had a major chilling effect. They were the first people in Russia who were imprisoned, given actual jail time for peaceful protest, not 15 days administrative arrest like those guys that they had performed for,
right.
But actual time in penal colonies that's measured in months and years. Since then, there have been dozens more. And it is very well understood that, that yes, you can go to jail and your entire life can change just because you take part in peaceful protest.
Yeah. Are you still in touch with them?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know if they have, I mean, with LGBT being one of sort of Nadia's founding principles, and with the whole, you know, this is what everyone is looking at Sochi for, is, you know, how will the ban on, how is it phrased, gay...
Homosexual propaganda.
Propaganda, right. I guess people are wondering, you know, will they be somehow active, vocal during the Olympics?
Well, they've been very vocal. I don't think that anyone has heard them very well, but they've been very vocal about calling for a boycott. Unfortunately, they came to this rather late. They were in prison until the end of December. There's this misguided idea that there are no Russian dissidents calling for a boycott. In fact, that's not true. And perhaps the most two of the most important and outspoken Russian dissidents, Maria Alekhina and Nadezhda Tolokonnikova, are calling for a full boycott of Sochi.
Well, as we've seen, after not all that much internal debate, most countries have sent full delegations, although none of the higher officials of our government will attend. But aside from that, do you expect to see them during the Olympics?
Well, they're not planning to go to Sochi. They have more important things to do.
Yeah.
They've devoted themselves full time to prisoners' rights. I do hope to see them in the media because, frankly, this is the last burst of major media, Western media attention to Russia for a while.
Yeah.
Russia is going to disappear from the front pages right after the Olympics. So I'm glad they are here, and I'm glad they're going to have their say.
We've been talking about the members of the Russian performance art and occasional punk band collective known as Pussy Riot. They are the subject of Masha Gessen's book, brand new. It's called Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Masha, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Soundcheck.
Унитазы начищены, курицы в штатском, призраки Жижика смыты в сортире. Химлес зачищен, у Чирикова недопуск, феминистки отправлены в декретный отпуск. Освободи, 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 брусчатку, освободи, 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 брусчатку.
Up next, a live performance in our studio from singer-songwriter Jason Isbell. This is Soundcheck.
And a big boy busting and screaming at his girlfriend, waving around a fungo bag.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the background, you're hearing the album Southeastern by singer-songwriter Jason Isbell, who used to play with the alt-country band Drive-By Truckers. Southeastern is filled with ballads that'll rip your heart out, but this rave-up is one of my favorites from the record. It's called Super 8, and it's about a raucous hotel room party that nearly ends in disaster.
If I ever get back to Bristol, I'm better off sleeping in the county jail. I don't want to die in a Super 8 motel.
Jason Isbell is clearly at a peak of his songwriting powers right now, and since Jason last joined us, he's gotten sober and gotten married to fellow musician Amanda Shires. Here is Jason Isbell with Amanda Shires performing the song Live Oak in the Soundcheck studio.
There's a man who walks beside me, he is who I used to be, and I wonder if she sees him and confuses him with me. And I wonder who she's pining for on nights I'm not around. Could it be the man who did the things I'm living down? I was rougher than the timber, shipping out of Fond du Lac. When I headed south at 17, a sheriff on my back. I never held a lover in my arms or in my gaze, so I found another victim every couple days. But the night I fell in love with her, I made my weakness known to the fighters and the farmers digging dusty fields alone. The jealous innuendo of the lonely hearted man let me know what kind of country I was sleeping in. Well, you couldn't stay alone or on the plains before the war. When my neighbors took to slighting me, I had to ask what for. Rumors of my wickedness had reached our little town. Soon she heard about the boys I used to hang around. We'd robbed a Great Lakes freighter, killed a couple men aboard. When I told her, her eyes flickered like the sharp steel of a sword. All the things that she'd suspected I'd expected her to fear was the truth that drew her to me when I landed here. There's a man who walks beside me, he is who I used to be, and I wonder if she sees him and confuses him with me. I wonder who she's pining for on nights I'm not around. Could it be the man who did the things I'm living down? Well, I carved a cross from live oak and her box from shortleaf pine, and buried her so deep she touched the water table line. Picked up what I needed and I headed south again. To myself I wonder, would I ever find another friend? There's a man who walks beside her, he is who I used to be, and I wonder if she sees him and confuses him with me.
That is Jason Isbell with Amanda Shires, live on Soundcheck, and a song called Live Oak. Jason Isbell playing the guitar and singing, Amanda Shires playing the fiddle. The album is called Southeastern. As I mentioned earlier, it was on a lot of best-of lists at the end of 2013. And for that, Jason, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And also, since the last time you were here, a lot has happened. You and Amanda, now married.
We
congratulations.
To each other, of all things.
Did you know when you were writing this album that it would turn out to be what it was, you know, something a little different from everything that had come before?
I knew that I'd put more time into the lyrics and the melodies, and I had a lot more focus. But you know, you question the thing that you're doing, and you're not positive. You're not ever really sure. Is this great, or is it junk? You know, some days I'd come home from the studio and I'd be great. You know, I'd be very happy about the work that we'd done, and then sometimes she would have to.
She being Amanda.
Yeah, Amanda would have to tell me. You know, no, it's good. It's going to be really great. It's the best work that you've done. And that helped, you know, that helped me get through the process without pulling my hair out.
Because one of the other processes that has gone on in your life since the last time you were here was you've gone through, you know, rehab, gotten sober and stuff, which I know you've talked a lot about. That's got to be hard to kind of continually go over that ground in interviews and stuff like
that. Yeah, it is. I mean, the opening up and talking about it part's not really hard anymore because I did that voluntarily early on, but... But, you know, there's been a lot of interviews, and I'm grateful for all those, but sometimes it's a little taxing.
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, every time you're on the radio or in print, some new group of fans who don't know your story are hearing it for the first time.
Of course, yeah. And it does me good to tell the story, you know. People who are, I think, in recovery from any kind of substance abuse know that the more times you tell somebody about your own personal struggles with it, the easier it is to keep yourself on the straight and narrow.
Yeah. The thing that made me think of it was you talking about coming out of the studio some days feeling great and other days feeling this is junk. You know, people who've gone through this process, sometimes creative people who go through it, they fear that they're going to lose that creative edge.
Yeah.
Did you have that fear?
I did, but, you know, I think it was more just an excuse, really. I think when you hear people say that, it's usually an excuse. Yeah. I think somewhere down inside them, they believe that that's not going to happen. That fear, you know, it's kind of posing as fear, but really it's just you saying, I want another drink or I want another pill or whatever, and I'm going to, you know, use this to get one. But that song, Live Oak, that I just played was about that, and worrying about my own personal effectiveness and attractiveness to Amanda and to my friends and to the people around me, and wondering if the person that I would wind up becoming would be, you know, as attractive as the person that I was before. And I'm glad I wrote it when I did, because now, you know, I don't think I'd be able to do that. I just don't have that concern anymore.
Let me ask you about the record title, Jason. Jason Isbell, Amanda Shires here with me in the Soundcheck studio. The album's called Southeastern. There are songs about Stockholm, New South Wales. You mentioned Fond du Lac, town in Wisconsin, in Live Oak, the song you just sang. I mean, there's a real sense of place in a lot of this record.
Yeah.
Was that intentional?
I think that's just what I was concerned with at the time. I like settings. I like it when you... or listening to a song and it puts you in a certain place or a certain time. I think that's probably my favorite thing about music in general is that, you know, when it's done really well, I think it puts you in a certain room.
Staring at the pictures of the runaways on the wall. Seems like these days you couldn't run away at all. And even if you did, what you got to run away to? Just another drunk daddy with a white man's point of view.
And Amanda, I mean, last time you were here, you were doing your own music. Have you and Jason, since you've gotten married, have you started writing together? Do you do a lot of playing together?
We do a lot of playing together. We write a little bit together. I think we're just taking our time with it. You know, you don't want to go into the candy shop and eat all the candy at once and then get sick. There's lots of time.
All right. Let's hear another song, a particularly effective but harrowing bit of songwriting from the album Southeastern. This song is called Elephant. Once again, Jason Isbell with Amanda Shires live on Soundcheck.
Said, Andy, you're better than your past. Winked at me and drained a glass. Cross-legged on a bar stool like nobody sits anymore. And she said, Andy, you're taking me home. But I knew she planned to sleep alone. I'd carry her to bed, sweep up the hair from the floor. If I'd f*** her before she got sick, I'd never hear the end of it. But she don't have the spirit for that now. We drink our drinks and laugh out loud, bitch about the weekend crowd, and try to ignore the elephant somehow. Somehow. She said, Andy, you cracked me up. Seagrams in a coffee cup. Sharecropper eyes, her hair almost all gone. When she was drunk, she made cancer jokes. She made up her own doctor's notes. Surrounded by her family, saw that she was dying alone. I'd sing her classic country songs. She'd get high and sing along. But she don't have the voice to sing with now. We burn these joints in effigy, cry about what we used to be, try to ignore the elephant somehow, somehow.
Jason Isbell and Amanda Shires with a song called Elephant from Jason's latest record called Southeastern. Jason singing and playing guitar, Amanda helping out with backing vocals and fiddle. Jason, let me read you a comment that was just posted on our website from Brian, who's listening in live. Every time I hear these songs, I find something new. Now, you've played these songs many, many times. Does that still happen for you, too?
you know, I try to put myself in the place that I was in when I wrote the songs, and they're very specific to me. You know, the characters that I use and the stories are very specific, and they have a certain memory for me that I try to conjure up every night when I'm singing them so I can mean them, you know, and deliver them the right way. So that pretty much all floods back to me every time I do these. It depends on who's in the audience, too, you know, and how the audience is reacting. Sometimes that song, Elephant, sometimes it's hard for me to get through it, you know, and I feel like it kind of should be. You know, you should get a little bit choked up sometimes when you're singing your own music.
Yeah. Is that, have you ever written, like, short stories? I mean, these songs are almost getting to that point.
Yeah, you know, but I don't consider songs as just second-rate short stories, you know what I mean? I'm not a fiction writer. I might at some point try to do that, but you know, to me a great song is just as impressive as a great piece of fiction, and I don't want to be a songwriter who writes a book, you know. Mm. If I do write a book, I don't think anybody would know it's me. I think it'd be under a pen name or something, because I would want to be, you know, thrown in the ring with the fiction that I read. And right now, I'm just not able to meet those standards.
Well, it's a fine piece of songwriting there.
Thanks.
Song "Elephant" from Jason Isbell. Amanda, last time you were on the show, you had just done a cameo in the movie Country Strong. Any more film work since we saw you last?
Well, you know, I'm always trying to get into movie films. I never get invited. I just show up.
Just walking around in the background.
Yeah.
She won't let me watch that one. She sent me some video of it on the phone the other day, and I thought it looked great.
It was a lot of fun, you know. I made a new record since then in August, and that's all, you know, writing songs, mm-hmm. playing the fiddle.
We're gearing up for the Olympics round here. What about you guys?
I could tell.
I am. I'm gearing up for the Olympics. I've got a regimen that I'm following.
Yes.
Not thinking about the Olympics.
Is that strenuous?
It's tough. It's getting harder and harder. It's getting harder and harder.
I'm gearing up for doing laundry soon.
Yeah, that's like an Olympic event.
You wild and wacky newlyweds.
Folding. It's like curling, but folding.
And you have to be like the Norwegian curling team with the bright colored costumes.
I saw them. Norwegians, they don't mess around with the bright colored clothing. They're pretty funny people.
Not a lot of sun up there half the year. You got to get your color somewhere.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
It's wacky.
We played in Stockholm, and I have a song.
Well, that's Sweden.
Yeah, in Sweden, and I have a song called Stockholm, and they loved it. And then the next night, we went to Oslo in Norway, and I was telling the story about playing that song the night before, and there's a guy in the crowd that said, "The Swedish are useless." And I said, "Excuse me, sir?"
The guy next to him said,
"Yeah." The guy next to him was like, "He's right. They're useless, the Swedish."
Someone probably should have warned you about the whole Swedish-Norwegian thing.
I know, because we can't do that in this country. We couldn't just pick, you know, Canadians or Mexicans and say they're useless. That you can't do that.
All right, guys. This has been a lot of fun having a chance to see you both again and to see you together. And Jason, congratulations on Southeastern. Terrific record. Thanks for playing for us.
I'm more excited about being married. But the record's also been a good thing.
He's not trained to say that. That sounded like he was trained to say that.
It didn't sound very excited,
no,
did it?
No, it didn't.
I'm very excited about being married.
You've heard the song. You know how understatement is my only trick. It's the only trick I have in my whole bag.
So. Oh, no.
I try to say everything kind of like Stephen Wright.
Jason Isbell, Amanda Shires. Guys, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I've heard love songs make a Georgia man cry on the shoulder of somebody's Saturday night. Read the good book, studied it too, but nothing prepared me for living.
If you enjoyed hearing Jason Isbell on today's show, you can hear an extra song and more conversation on soundcheck.org or subscribe to our free podcast. Coming up, David Frick of Rolling Stone joins us to talk about a guitarist's guitarist, the blues rock innovator Mike Bloomfield. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The blues had a huge influence on a whole generation of rock guitarists, many of whom would go on to be the pillars of rock and roll in the 60s. Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck. But how many people remember the name Mike Bloomfield? Not nearly enough, according to Rolling Stone senior editor David Frick. David wrote a piece for the most recent edition of the magazine detailing why Mike Bloomfield is rock's greatest forgotten guitar hero. David Frick, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much.
So, in a nutshell, who was Mike Bloomfield?
Mike Bloomfield was the first guitar hero. At a time when Eric Clapton was essentially still learning his craft, still figuring out how to take the power of rock, the power of the British invasion as he grew up with it in Britain, and apply it to Robert Johnson, to Albert King, to Buddy Guy, Mike Bloomfield was already there. He grew up in Chicago. He was born there in the suburbs, had spent time in the early 60s in the black clubs. He was befriending people like Sleepy John Estes, Big Joe Williams, Muddy Waters was his friend. Howlin' Wolf would call him up to jam. This is all in 62 and 63, before Eric Clapton was even on record. So Bloomfield was actually finding a way to take the rock and roll he loved, the instrument that was really almost an extension of his personality, and applying it to this music that had so much mystery and power for him and sensuality, and doing it with a totally unique language. In the story, when I talked to Jimmy Vivino, who plays in the Conan Band, you know, he basically described what is called the Bloomfield tone. Turn up the treble, turn up the mid-range, no bass, all amplify. No pedals, no distortion other than what's natural from the amplifier. And the rest of it comes from the wrists and the heart.
How soon was it before people started cottoning on to what Mike Bloomfield was doing? How long before people like Eric Clapton took notice?
Clapton, in 1966, is quoted as saying, "Mike Bloomfield is music on two legs." He had heard the Butterfield records, Bob Dylan's
Paul,
Like a Rolling Stone,
Paul
Butterfield's blues band. He had heard Like a Rolling Stone. He had heard Highway 61. He heard what Mike Bloomfield can do on record already. It was astonishing.
So how much of, I mean, the famous Bob Dylan at Newport, the Newport Folk Festival, 1965, plugging and going electric, he's there with him, right?
Bloomfield was there. Bloomfield was at Like a Rolling Stone, which is really the beginning of that seismic moment. You know, Al Kooper talks about walking into the session for Like a Rolling Stone, expecting to play guitar, sits down, unpacks. This kid that he's never met before from Chicago walks in, says, "Hi, how you doing?" Unpacks, starts warming up. Cooper says, "Okay, I'm not doing this. I cannot do what he's doing." To a lot of people, it was as if Bloomfield had flown in from outer space. This whole thing is just happening at such incredible velocity. And all of a sudden, he's there, this, you know, paragon
so
of expression.
So he's this Zelig-like character at the birth of several different major trends in 1960s rock music, including being with Dylan at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965. Listen to Mike Bloomfield helping out Bob Dylan on this version of Maggie's Farm.
I ain't gonna work for Maggie's Farm no more.
Mike Bloomfield on electric guitar with Bob Dylan. Dylan famously going electric at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965, that performance of Maggie's Farm. We are remembering Mike Bloomfield because David Frick is remembering him. Rock's greatest forgotten guitar hero, as David calls him, for the most recent edition of Rolling Stone. One of the reasons he is forgotten, David, is that he seems to have been allergic to success.
He just had a natural instinct to walk away from something just as it was about to break. Partly, I think, because he didn't want to be imprisoned by it. You know, Mark Naftalin in the piece talks about this almost ritual behavior. As soon as he comes close to something, he turns away. And Cooper tells this story about during the Highway 61 sessions about, you know, Mike, Al Cooper, and Harvey Brooks, the bass player, having dinner. And Mike is saying, well, you know, if Bob forms a band to take this music on the road, you should do it because I'm not.
Mm.
Like, why not? Because he wants to stay with Paul Butterfield. He wants to play blues. And then as soon as Butterfield really hits an incredible peak with East West, this incredible raga jazz interpretation of Chicago blues, he walks away to form ultimately the great American R&B band, the Electric Flag. That record comes out, he's gone by the time the record comes out and, you know, goes on to make half of Super Session.
But before we get to that, you mentioned the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. What was the importance of the Paul, aside from the music itself, the importance of the Paul Butterfield Blues Band in 1960s America?
Paul Butterfield Band was not only authentic Chicago blues, they were the first, I think, serious improvisers. Obviously, the great Chicago bands, all of those people could play. Buddy Guy, an amazing soloist, mm-hmm. you know. Muddy Waters, you didn't want to try and cut him, you know, on a Monday night in Chicago. But with Mike Bloomfield, Elvin Bishop, and Paul Butterfield on harp, the three of those guys were, they were serious explorers.
And when you say harp, you mean the blues?
Harmonica.
The harmonica.
Yes, not the Harpo Marx. You know, they were serious explorers. They right. were interpolating John Coltrane. They were listening to Ravi Shankar, and they were finding the common ground mm-hmm. with Robert Johnson, with Willie Dixon, and electricity.
And how important was it that this was a black and white mixed band?
It was very rare at that time to have a, really an integrated band. The only other band that could be comparable would be Booker T and the MGs, mm-hmm. and they were primarily a rhythm section. They
right.
were a great performing band, but they were primarily a supportive unit.
From the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, once again featuring the great guitarist Mike Bloomfield. In 1966, the Paul Butterfield Blues Band recorded their album East West. That's a little bit of the title track, a kind of, you know, epic length excursion into both blues and Indian raga, and featuring Mike Bloomfield on guitar. David Frick, senior editor at Rolling Stone magazine, has written a profile of Mike Bloomfield for the most recent edition of that magazine, and there's a box set.
Yes.
So there are people beginning to take notice of this overlooked star.
Bloomfield has always been someone who's been sort of on the margins. Robbie Robertson has talked about him.
Yeah.
Carlos Santana talks about him as being a serious primary influence on him when he was growing up in San Francisco because the Butterfield Band played there, Mike moved there. So a lot of the people that we consider guitar heroes now, Clapton, they all worshipped this guy.
He was the guitar hero's guitar hero.
He was the guy before there were guitar heroes.
Yeah.
And he also had a knack for playing with extraordinary musicians. One of the things about East West, when you listen to that, listen to the rhythm section, the bass and drums. It's steady but buoyant, mm-hmm. which gives, it's like a trampoline. It gives you so much room and so much energy for him to fly in those modal bursts of energy.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with David Frick about Mike Bloomfield, whose career would then eventually wend its way to things under his own name. You alluded before to Super Session, which came out in 68.
1968, yes. Super Session is characteristic of Bloomfield in that it wasn't his idea. It was Al Kooper's idea. Mm. And he thought, you know, Mike had left Butterfield. The Electric Flag had made actually a really good record, but there had been problems within the group, tensions, drugs. Mike leaves before the record's even out. You know, the guy's drifting. So Al decides, you know, this is a guy who doesn't really get along with producers. So I'm just going to put him in the studio. We'll jam. Mm-hmm. You know, it should be the easiest thing in the world.
So yeah. Al is playing keyboards.
Al is playing keyboards. You know, Harvey Brooks is back on bass. Barry Goldberg, who was Mike's friend from high school in Chicago, he's also on keyboards. And so this should be a piece of cake. They go in one night at the end of May. They record five tracks, and Bloomfield splits. He just he doesn't call. You know, Al talks to him. He left me a note. Can't sleep. Went home. You know, leaves Los Angeles, goes back to San Francisco. Cooper has a record to finish. He calls all around town. The only guy who calls him back and says he'll be there is Stephen Stills. That's why Stephen Stills is on side two of Super Session. So here's, and this is a record that ultimately goes top 20. It is the biggest record, the best-selling record Bloomfield ever had under his own name, and he's only on half
He's only on half of it.
I think that says so much about his career drive.
Called Albert's Shuffle from the album Super Session, credited to guitarist Mike Bloomfield, and indeed half of the record at least features Mike Bloomfield on guitar, the other half Stephen Stills, who, as David Frick just told us, filled in when Bloomfield absconded from L.A. and went back home to try and sleep, which was a problem throughout his life and a problem that probably contributed to further you know, he seems to go from strength to strength until you hit 1970, and then things take a nasty turn.
He was someone who just, he had commitment issues. He continued to play. He actually made, you know, almost a dozen records over the last decade of his life for small labels. He would do these little tours. But his idea of having a career, of having drive, it was either never really there or it just dissipated. The insomnia certainly was a major factor, and the fact that he, to some degree, tried to medicate it mm-hmm. with heroin to bring down that intensity. And Barry Goldberg talks about just the way his brain was on fire all the time. The only way he could sort of turn it off was to literally deaden it. And unfortunately, that cycle took a really tragic toll.
Yeah.
It's worth noting, though, that in basically maybe 3 months before his death, he reunites with Dylan on stage in San Francisco. Dylan brings him on stage to play with him. And that track, one of that tracks, is on the box set. Mm-hmm. And you can hear every gift that the man had was still there. But 3 months later, the man himself was not.
What year are we talking about here?
Well, he died in 1981. This was in the fall of 1980.
Right. The box set is called From His Head to His Heart to His Hands, being released this week. There's also a documentary film related to this project about guitarist Mike Bloomfield. How old was he when he died, and how did he die?
He was 37, and he was found in a car out, and he had died of an overdose.
Heroin.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So where does he belong, ultimately, in the pantheon of rock legends?
Well, I think he belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He isn't there yet. I don't get it, but, you know, he was my first guitar hero. He was the guy that I listened to religiously. I loved Clapton, the Yardbirds, the Velvets, all of that stuff was important to me. But the guy who taught me that the guitar was an instrument of power, expression, and emotion, the first guy to do that was Bloomfield. And the thing that's really amazing about his work, the best and most important work he did, Dylan, Butterfield, The Flag, Super Session, he did it all in 4 years. Hmm.
Well, Soundcheck listeners, check out our website, soundcheck.org, for a link to David Frick's list of essential listening from guitarist Mike Bloomfield. David Frick is senior editor at Rolling Stone magazine and wrote about Bloomfield for the most recent edition of Rolling Stone. David, good to see you again.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
On the show, our series From Russia with Soundcheck continues with a look at New York's Russian community in the Brighton Beach neighborhood, plus the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' arrival in the States, and an in-studio session from Steve Earle. To get updates when we post in-studio performances and great conversations, follow us on Twitter @Soundcheck or like us on Facebook. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.